Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to audio and video content, episode archives, monthly roundtables, a book club, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
Hot take.
I love food. I'm kind of addicted to food shows and cooking shows. I'm really obsessed with MasterChef, and my toxic trait is thinking that I too could go on that show and somehow eke out a win against world-class chefs. I don't know why. But I love food. Everybody loves food, right? I mean, everybody, even if we don't love the same food, we love food. Okay, there was this one guy that I used to work with who claimed that he hated food because it interfered with his ability to be productive and it was time out of his day, but I'm pretty sure that guy was a robot. There's a thing that's missing in the conversation that we all have with one another about food. It's in the eating of food. Right? We shame one another if we admit that we like to eat or we eat certain kinds of foods, snacks that are considered unhealthy or carbs during summer, or if you're a person of color or a person of size, being seen eating certain foods comes with it a burden of unearned shame. My guest today writes about food and shame. In fact, her new book, Eating While Black, Food Shaming and Race in America, specifically seeks to create conversation around eating and the ways in which Black people specifically, but all people who experience levels of intersectional oppression, are shamed for eating. Her name is Dr. Psyche Williams-Forson, and she is a professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland. And she is my guest today. Here she is. Dr. Psyche Williams-Forson, thank you so much for being here on Head on Fire. I appreciate you coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. So for folks who don't know you or your work, tell people a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Psyche Williams-Forson, and I'm a professor and department chair in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park. And a lot of folks will ask, what is American Studies? Well, we study the broad concepts, if you will, of culture, of life, of the things we sort of take for granted every day. Some of us study this through the realm of popular cultures, social media, so forth. Some of us study the environment, religion. I happen to study the material world, and so the things that we deal with in our everyday lives, and in particular, right now, I've been studying for the last 20 years or so, food and culture. And so at the University of Maryland, in particular, we are interested in identities of difference and how all of us are very complex human beings. And so these things permeate our lives, our everyday lives, right? You cannot separate who you are from how you are necessarily, right? And so we train our students to understand culture in its broadest sense and to, as humanist, as people who study the human condition and human ways of being, how do we move about the world in the very myriad kinds of ways and things that we encounter every day.
You used a phrase there that I want to ask you about, identities of difference. I think a lot of people these days are familiar with the concept of intersectionality. Does identities of difference and intersectionality share space? Are they two different terms?
Right.
How do those differentiate?
Yeah, absolutely. They share space. They're in conversation with each other. One of the things that I think we have been socialized to believe is we're just human. You see this a lot, and I'm on lots of different social media sites, and Twitter is one of my favorite. And so people say, at the end of the day, we're all human. Yes, and the part we don't want to grapple with so much is we're all human in our complexities, right? We all have ways of operating in the world. We as a society have categorized those ways as gender, as race, as class, in very discrete boxes, as if that's the way people move about the world. And we don't. We evolve every day, right? And so some of us have fluidity of gender. Some of us have fluidity of class. We have fluidity perhaps of race, if that's how folks want to show up in the world. And what we as Americans, certainly, but as people, I think, are resistant to doing is allowing other people space to be who they are, as they are, how they are, right? Because, and on the one hand, having studied culture for over 30 years, you understand that. I understand that because it makes things very messy. It makes people very messy. And most of us like to believe that the world is neat and compartmentalized, and it's not. Part of the beauty of being human is that we're messy, right? We have a lot of fluidity about our lives. And so what one of the things we do in American Studies is we teach people to understand that and to recognize it and to even see it in themselves, right? That we all have different identities, and we move in and out of those identities every day, every year, over the course of many years, so forth and so on. And that is part of the beauty of human life.
I was in conversation with Dr. Naomi Jacobs. She's overseas in Europe. And one of the things that she talked about, she's a disability advocate. And one of the things that she tries to get people to understand is when you have this conversation of we're all just human, you know, I don't see difference, I don't see race, I don't see disability, I don't see these things. At the end of the day, we're all just human. She said, you know, be careful with that kind of language because it still does create a default. You are creating a default, and then everyone else is deviations from that norm. Instead, seeing people as their whole self allows for understanding of what different people need to be able to exist equitably.
That's right. No, that's right. She's 100% right. You know, when folks say, I don't see race, I don't, well, then you're discounting who I am.
Yeah.
Because my experience in the world as a Black woman may be very different from your experience in the world as a white woman, as a white man, as a Latina woman, a Latina man. I mean, these things matter. And you know where they matter the most, Don, often is in policy. They show up so often in policy. So when we invisibilize these things, then we're saying we don't see how these policies are written in such a way that they disenfranchise this community or disenfranchise that community or disenfranchise that community. Let me put this in more concrete terms. You're seeing me as just human means you are not prepared to recognize if I have a mental health challenge. So when that challenge shows up, you see me as deviant as opposed to seeing me as a person with a mental health challenge because it's not rendered visible, right? If I show up and I have a visible disability, you're unprepared to work with me as I am, whether I'm aided by a wheelchair, an earpiece, whatever the case may be, because you're so intent upon just seeing me. That means you don't recognize I may eat differently in public. I may move differently in public. I may be hindered by your inability to only to not see me as who I am, but only see me as human. That means I can't get to this event because you don't have the apparatus I need to be able to navigate that space. So it's really problematic and dangerous, quite frankly, when we don't see people in the myriad complex ways in which we actually exist in the world.
You know, I was just talking to the author, Ayanna Gray, and we were kind of talking about how in the writer space, I'm a writer and I talk to a lot of writers and authors and things, how there've been these burgeoning conversations, not burgeoning, boiling conversations for years and years and years about how authors very often get it wrong when writing characters of color, white authors writing characters of color, or abled authors writing disabled characters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And very often, you know, the author will say something like, oh, well, you know, I'm drawing from experience, or we should be able to paint the world. You know, it's all of these very lofty things. But, you know, what Ayana pointed out was that just the moment that you change that person's identity, you're changing their entire outlook. Yeah. On how they would see the world, but you're also changing the entire narrative of your story. How would other characters see you?
Right.
And I just think that no matter in what space we're in, you know, American studies, literary, you know, the literature world and everything, I think people forget that that just tiny change of perspective is not so tiny. It's this seismic shift in moving around the world, or not moving around the world as it is.
No, that's really right. You know, I'll share something with you. One of my favorite writers is Chimamanda Adichie, a Nigerian novelist, right? So as a writer, I'm sure you're familiar. And, you know, and I many years ago, I encountered her TED Talk, The Danger of the Single Story. And I use this a lot. I use it in my book. I use it a lot in my classroom. And from time to time, I go back to the actual TED Talk and re-listen, because there's so many nuggets that she provides there. And one of the ones that she provides that I want to share very quickly that speaks to your point is she explains that her family was a conventional middle-class Nigerian family, is what she says. Her parents were professionals. And so, as would be the custom, she explains, her family had lived in domestic help, right? And they would come from the nearby rural villages. So when she was a child, they had a young servant boy come to live with them. And she said the only thing her mother told them about this young boy was that he was very poor, right? And so her mom would send food and clothes to the family. When she didn't finish her dinner, her mom would say, you know, finish your food. Don't you know there are people like his family who don't have food? Okay, so she took enormous pity on his family. Then one day they went to his village, and she said his mother showed them, when they visited, a very beautifully patterned basket that had been made by this young boy's brother. And she says, and I'm going to quote her for just a moment. She says, I was startled. It had not occurred to me that anybody in his family could actually make something. All I had learned about them was how poor they were. So it had become impossible for me to see them as anything but poor. Their poverty was my single story of them, right? And such a powerful reference, yeah? In part because when we don't see what Avery Gordon, sociologist Avery Gordon, says in her book, Ghostly Matters, when we don't see people's complex personhood or even their possibility of having personhood, right? We completely are not prepared when they show up differently, as if we're not able to show up differently, right? Or we render people, as Adichie mentions, as a single story. And so then we develop stereotypes about people that are not true. Maybe there's some partial element of truth, but for the most part, stereotypes alone tend to be based in some element of truth. But what we do is we full swipe, make them the stereotype, you know, because we don't want to know that though we're all from the same race, or we identify in the same gender, or from the same class, or differing or same abilities, we're not the same people.
And what's interesting is that when you do those kinds of things, when you assign a role to somebody based on one single quality, when they deviate from that, like your beautiful example, it really upsets people. When you see a poor person with a new iPhone, it upsets a lot of people.
Oh my God.
When you see somebody that uses a wheelchair stand up and walk for a little ways because their disability is not keeping them completely bound to the wheelchair at all times, it upsets people.
That's
because
right.
You know, we're all human and we're all in it together, and I'm an ally, but as long as you stay in that chair.
That's right. And that goes back to my initial point about our need to compartmentalize people so that we can make sense of them. Because very few of us want to walk about the world having what we think is a status quo shifted and upheaved, right? We want to see people as who they say they are. This is largely what's happening right now in our society, right? The upheaval is catching so many people off guard because for the last 50 to 60, 70 years, it has been this way, right? So just to, I mean, even to say with the election of President Obama, oh my God, you've shifted the
Racism's
landscape.
over.
Oh my God, racism is over. It's all different now. Everything is hunky dory. And then you get this backlash because people are like, wait a minute, we can't have this shift because now we're losing power. Well, no, you're really not. Especially when you think about policies and ownership and wealth in this country, the only people who are winning are the people who've always been winning. It just the landscape may look different and it's now rumbling, you know. But to sort of say, oh my God, we're, you know, throwing out all baby with all bathwater, what have you, whatever metaphor you want to use. That's because we, as a society of people, and certainly in our educational system, do not teach people the fluidity of culture, nor do we teach history in a way that people have to understand that things come in cycles, and what we're seeing now, we have seen before. That's
Learning
you
history as an adult and learning history by what is required in the
right.
public school system are two different
It's
histories. They are two different
totally different
histories.
histories, right? They're very different histories because, again, we don't, you know, we always talk about challenging other countries, and yet we don't want to step out there and challenge folks to think in complex ways as if we're not capable of doing this. You know, this is the reason why we feel so wedded to, you know, one language, because, you know, who wants to do all of that, right? And yet, the majority of the world, if not all the world except us, operates under multiple languages and multiple cultural associations and so forth. And yet, again, as I said, culture is messy. People are human and people are complex. And the one way of thinking is just not far be, I mean, I'm not even at xenophobia. I'm simply saying thinking in one dimension becomes problematic even unto yourself. Because if your scenario changes, you're likely to fall completely apart
Oh
because, you
man, yeah.
know, you can't handle the change and the transition, you know. And so you don't understand resilience and you don't understand life happens to us all and people are born and people die and people gain and people lose, and then you have a subset of people who just sort of stay right there, right? And everything stays the same.
Your new book is Eating While Black. It's gorgeous. I'm excited about it. We love talking about food. Everybody loves talking about food. My entire social media feed is I love food. Everybody loves food. But we have a tough time talking about eating. Why is that?
Yeah, partly because it's so every day, right? And I think, you know, it's very every day and we take it for granted. Okay. What we don't want to, we love the visuality of food, right? We are on social media, IG or what have you, and we're like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. But here again, very seldom do we want to think about where that food comes from, the process by which it arrived at our table, whether that's in the slaughter of animals or in the picking of fruits and vegetables, the people who did that work, the conditions under which they did that work. What we want is what's in front of us in all of its beauty, right? And so that all of that is encompassed in the eating. All these things I just finished saying are encompassed in the eating. I had an experience 2 days ago. I took my mom and my goddaughter. We were at Subway. We had a My goddaughter was intent upon going to Starbucks. So I had to like double.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so as we were being served, I began to get more and more agitated for a couple of reasons. One, there were a number of signs. The person who was making our food, there were only two folks in the restaurant. This is a small Subway. And one person, the person who was making our food, her energy was more and more dismissive, if you will. She started throwing things around and plopping the food down. And so over as she's making the food, I'm like, oh my gosh, why am I feeling so anxious right now? And then I saw these signs up in the restaurant, really small ones. We strive to have good customer service. If you don't, then you need to contact. And so by the time she finished, I said, this establishment is very close to the university, and we do a lot of business with the local restaurants. We like to patronize local restaurants. And I said, I'm very concerned right now because A, your entire energy is being transferred to this sandwich, how you are preparing and handling our food is being transferred. And I was like, and I'm not happy. But for the fact that my goddaughter wanted her sandwich, I would have walked away. But we don't necessarily respect, I think, cosmic processes in this, right? We don't respect that how your food is prepared from cross-contamination to anger to happiness. Those things get embedded in how we make our food products. And then, we eat those things. These are things we're ingesting, we're putting in our body. And I think we often want to just be excited about the visual, but not about the cosmic, the spiritual, the physical acts that go into what happens after it's prepared. So many of the images that we see are actually not real when we see them in magazines or what, when they go back and tell you how that this is not really syrup, it's motor oil, because motor oil,
That bread is
that is
styrofoam.
styrofoam, right? And so when you see that kind of thing, you recognize not so much that you were duped, but that there's an illusion of beauty, right? And that the reality tends to be far more problematic, different, less tasteful, whatever the case is that you want to add. So I think we don't like to talk about those things, Don. That destroys the experience for a lot of people.
The subtitle of your book is Food Shaming, and Race in America. And I want to talk about what is food shaming for people that might be a new term for, but also how is it specifically impacting Black people, because those are the folks that are very much centered in your work, but how does it impact those who do deviate from the norm, whatever that norm is, generally speaking?
So I came to this topic after my first book, Building Houses Out of Chicken Legs, Black Women, Food and Power. I published that in 2006. And when I that was part of my doctoral thesis, or it was my doctoral thesis. And when I was working on it, I started out working on that book because I was interested in Black people's connection to food stereotypes. Several things happened that before I really started on that project, but one of them was that Tiger Woods won the Masters tournament, right? The Masters golf tournament the first time around. And after he won, one of his fellow golfers said, told him, don't choose, fried chicken, watermelon, or collard greens, whatever the hell those people eat, right? And suffered, backlash as a result of it. So that led me down this path of studying stereotypes in Black people because I said, really? Is it like 2000? Are we still talking about Black people and chicken? So, you know, I wrote the book. As I was touring nationally and internationally talking about the book, several things were happening in the food world. One, dollar stores, and especially the Dollar Tree, started getting refrigeration. And so that meant the number of products they could offer food-wise began to expand, right? More and more people started turning to gardening and community gardens in particular. And that became, and then farmers markets started to really have a social resurgence, right? They became these spaces. And I would have these people come up to me and say things like, how do we get people to stop eating fast food? How do we get more people to grow gardens? And gardening is the best thing in the world. And more of us need to be vegan and vegetarian. So all these dictates started going on. And,
Those are
you know,
so, those are just so vastly different. Those are such vastly different conversations.
oh, these are very different conversations. And I had a really hard time with this book because I'm like, oh my God,
How do
all these
you
things
correlate you need to be gardening with stop eating at McDonald's? Like, okay, sorry,
say
please go
that.
on.
But
That's just
a lot
blowing
of
my
people,
mind.
yes, but a lot of people, this is what they think. Stop eating fast food, start growing your own food. You'll
As
be
if that's an
growing better.
option,
As if that's
as if both of those things are equal options for everyone.
and there you have it right there, right? That's where the food shaming starts to come in because let me see. So the book came out in 2006, and now this one is coming out in 2022. So that's 16 years. And you can imagine, I have been hearing this for years, like people, how do we get people to grow gardens? I was like, well, did you ask the people if they want to grow a garden? You know? And so I began to see that this food shaming was really about controlling people's movements in their bodies and their actions. Because overwhelmingly, for the most part, it tended to be white women and mostly white women, asking me these questions about Black people. But there were also a fair number of Black women. And so at first I said this is food shaming and food policing. And then we just kind of whittled it down to food shaming. Because it's not just about children eating in the cafeteria of different immigrant communities who were enjoying their family food ways only to have someone say, oh, what is that? Or, oh my God, it smells horrible. You know, it wasn't just that. It was a lot more insidious. And this is what I try to talk about in the book because it's everyday life and it's so normalized that, again, back to what I started with, right? That these issues show up, these issues of denying difference show up in policies, right? And so, for example, in the book, I talk about, you know, an organization who built a farmers market. And one of the things they did was I was told they got a grant on the basis of them establishing this farmers market in an area that, by and large, had gentrified a formerly Black community. And they created this market, and yet there were no Black vendors, or there was one. And that person was a, I think, viticulturist. Am I saying the word right? They harvested worms. And yet they wanted folks to come, and they offer EBT and other kinds of, you know, services. But most of what they had was grass fed this, grass fed that, you know, grass fed that. And the prices were astronomical. I wouldn't have been able to shop. Now I'm gainfully and fully employed, thankfully. It was way too expensive for me. So I began to say, you know, how are we again engaging our food worlds? And how are we taking so much for granted that we're continuing? In our very actions, we're shaming other people's lives. And I start the book with an incident that happened in Washington, D.C. on the metro, where an African American or a Black woman metro worker was eating lunch or eating on the metro. And a picture was taken of her by an author, interestingly, and posted on Twitter. And she essentially, the caption sort of referenced the fact that for many, many years, Metro said you could not eat or drink or do any play music loud on the Metro. And so she took this picture and posted it of the woman on Twitter. And you know, why do that? Now she received quite a bit of backlash for that, but why are you shaming this person who's simply trying to eat, clearly dressed in a Metro uniform? As it turns out, according to the Washington Post, a mandate had gone out that said you know, Metro police weren't to fine people any longer for doing these very daily necessary acts. Well, the Metro worker probably knew that. This woman did not. And so here again, as we are shaming people for moving about their lives, we're operating with microscopic pieces of information. Whereas the person for whom or about whom we are shaming is very clear about what's happening in them. Okay, and so essentially, so this young woman asked me one time, you know, she said, "How do we get people to stop eating at McDonald's?" And it was an embarrassing question, really, because in the event that we were in the event that we were in, she there was my colleague was there with her daughter, and she had traveled very a lot of miles to come hear this panel that we were on. And one of the things she had told me before the panel started, so before this question was asked, she was like, "I know, you know, we're rushing from church service or whatever. We had to stop at McDonald's on the way here." So here's a really busy mom trying to get to this panel to get some information to continue her research. And folks are asking questions like, "How do we get people to stop eating at McDonald's?" You don't know what's going on in this person's life. You know, so why are we making these judgments about people's lives, right? So yeah, you know, it's that kind of thing that I try to show different scenarios that would not ordinarily be considered as elements of food shaming.
Food is so integral to identity, not just because of, the fact that it's what keeps us alive, it's what nourishes us, but it's also such a part of our culture. It's a part of our families. It's so closely tied to memory. I'm curious how your work is inclusive of the ways that when other people interact that are not from our specific community, when other people interact with food that is foreign to them in some kind of way, and that interaction is ew, ew, how does that impact, how does that impact a person? How does that impact a person's psyche? Not to use your name there, but how is that kind of thing? My husband's Mexican, and I know that very often, we think of Mexican food and we think of just a few different things, but I've been with him for 16 years, and there's just a world of food that is so important and ancient and that they don't make around people they don't really know here, because some of it's just they don't really want to hear you go, ew. They don't really want to hear you go, that kind of thing. How is your work inclusive of those kinds of conversations? How can maybe we get better about those kinds of conversations?
Yeah, you know, there's so many different instances of food shaming, many of which I don't cover in the book because I wanted to start a conversation,
Of course, of
right?
course.
And hopefully I left it open for other people to pick it up and move with it. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And I may have mentioned this, I can't really recall. My ex-husband is from Ghana, West Africa. And when we first started dating, you know, he was I we were talking at one point when he was eating, and I said, "Oh, you know, what are you eating?" And he got really quiet, and he said, "You know, fufu or what have you." And I said, "Oh, okay." Now, I'm very comfortable with the people eating with their hands, because as one of our my food colleagues says, we eat first with our hands, or we see first with our hands, right? or something to that extent. But he said, I really rarely tell people what I'm eating or how, and I don't like to eat around other people because when they see me eating with my hands, they say that very thing. Ew, what? Why are you eating with your hands? And yet we eat pizza with our hands. We eat various foods with our hands, but the moment
Fries,
you make
chips,
rice,
popcorn,
fries,
all the
chips,
good
you need
stuff. All the good stuff is with our hands.
oftentimes unclean hands, right?
Oh,
But the moment,
yeah.
but the moment someone scoops fufu and then soup in a very poetic kind of way, because you have to be adept to be able to do that and to, especially hot food, then all of a sudden it becomes ew. And so this circles back to our initial opening in this conversation. So thank you for asking those early questions, because what it says is you're willing to see me as human up until the point where it makes you uncomfortable. And rather than ask wonderful questions or say to me, wow, that I would never think that I could eat soup with my hands. How do you learn that? And engage me in a conversation. I think it's a reflection of our own, quite frankly, ignorance and inability to expand our thinking when we just resort to, oh my God, what? Ugh. I may not like turtle, terrapin, whatever, frog, whatever, and some other culture might, but I'm not gonna, say, oh my God, that's disgusting. What I'm gonna say is, no, thank you. I don't know that, because I see these animals in a different context. I'm not interested in trying that. I don't like snails. I don't like things that crawl and are creepy. I have a girlfriend who loves unagi, right? And she love, I mean, when we go out, she'll eat, when she's eating sushi, and I'll just say, yes, I'll take something different. But what I'm not going to do is food shame her and be like, oh my God, that's so disgusting. I was on an I got a tweet yesterday or a TikTok, I think, where a young woman said, I'm from Arkansas and this is how we eat. This is one way we like to eat boiled eggs. And she had a bowl full of boiled eggs, and she put a lot of white vinegar and a lot of salt, and then she was eating it. People were like, oh my God, that soupy egg. Ugh. And I said, actually, it's almost like pickles or pickled eggs,
Or even if you're just putting hot sauce on
or
it,
if
because
you're
so many
just
of
putting hot
those bottles
salt,
of Tabasco and stuff, that's
Tabasco,
just
which has
mostly vinegar and salt
vinegar and
and a
salt.
little cayenne and stuff in it.
Exactly. And
Yeah.
so as I looked at it, I was like, she's pickling her eggs.
Yeah. Ish, yeah. I'm
It
like, that
made her
probably tastes
look,
good.
yeah, for her, it was really good. And people are like, oh my God, it's soupy. It's okay. Got it. And everybody's entitled to their reaction. But before we have that reaction, we might want to stop to think, what is it that I may eat that may not be visually appealing when it is made, but it could taste really good? For a lot of people, that's barbecue.
Sure.
You don't want to see a whole cow, hog, whatever being, but for some folks, they're like, oh my God, that's the epitome of a good life, or even a whole bowl full of eggplant, oh my God, or okra. And for some people, tomatoes, So again, what I'm trying to get people to think about is the beauty of our cultural difference, right? And that when Black people in particular are constantly bombarded with these rules and regulations around eating, what's really going on there? Right. And so that's where the race part comes in, because my focus is primarily on African Americans. And I tie those types of activities to a measure of anti-racial Blackness that is so ingrained in our everyday lives that even Black people sometimes perpetuate it. Right. Or we don't see when a particular level of shaming is taking place, because it's rooted in religion, or it's rooted in our own cultural values, or it's rooted in whatever other practice of life we have. I've shared this in the last couple of weeks for a lot of different people. Many African Americans are told often, you're going to die because you have diabetes or high blood pressure or what have you. And one of the things I say in every talk I give, and this one will be no exception, is we have to be very, very careful about making food do the heavy lifting. Let's stop assigning all of this to food, because it's not necessarily so much food that is causing me to die early in America. There are so many other things that could cause me to die early in America, including just waking up in the morning to a battering ram. Or to being shot outside my apartment because someone, came into my apartment from elsewhere. Or I could go jogging and have a great diet and be out jogging and be hunted down like an animal. Or I could be driving while black and act, run a stop sign. Or my tags could be as I was very nervous for the last month because I had just moved and I had to renew my registration in May. And in the course of my moving, MVA decided not to send me my registration because I was literally so close to moving. I changed my address right around the same time as my registration. So for weeks, I was driving around with this, little notice in the back of my window saying, "Hey, my registration's up to date, even though my tag is not." And then it expired. And I was like, "Oh my God, what the heck do I do?" Now, if I were being, and I'm sure there were a couple of times I was because law enforcement was behind my car, and I'm sure they ran my plate only to find out my plates were up to date. But the fact that I could have gotten someone who pulled me over and that could have been the end of my life has nothing to do with food. Right? And so we have to be careful about saying it's food that's killing us because that allows us to take away from the systemic issues and the institutional issues in this country. That could kill and do kill everyone or any one of us on any given basis, any given day.
It very much it does echo sort of that first set of questions that we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation about when we just see one another as human. Air quotes, when we just see one another as people and we ignore all of the standard deviations from that cisgender, heterosexual, white, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera person, we are erasing all of the different areas of intersectional oppression that those groups experience. Is it the food that's killing people, or is it the fact that they live in a food desert? Is it the fact that they do not have access to health care? Is it the fact that they do not have access to mental health care? Is it the fact that, they've had a cavity that's been going on for years and it's gotten worse and now it's led to an infection and now they can't get treatment for it?
That's right.
Whatever it is, can they not travel to get to a good paying job can because of where they live? And there are so many questions that we just stop asking when we
Sure.
see what a person looks like and what they're eating. And that's, I think, what's so intriguing about your work is that you tell us, one, that yes, the eating is important, and there are many layers of important conversations to be had here, but it cannot be the entirety of the conversation. And in fact, many times it shouldn't be the conversation.
Yeah, that's right. And Don, I just want to jump in for a second and say we really need to change the notion of deviation because the reality is the majority of us, all of us, live in a place where the deviancy is wealth.
Oh, very much. Yes. Yes.
That really is the deviant because the majority of us are not wealthy,
Oh, yes. And I think
right? And
and so
so,
many people the last couple of years have realized how quick they are,
how quick they are.
how quick it is to get from where you are to where that person is that you think you'll never
Exactly.
be.
You'll never be, right? So when we start talking about how people deviate, if nothing else, we have learned in the last 6 to 8 years how much the majority of us, or all of us actually, live in the messiness. All of us live in the messiness. How that gets realized, it tends when you're wealthy, you're able to cover it a lot more. Right? So, to your point, there are many of us who live without mental health, physical health, dental health, any one of those, all of them. I mean, I'm talking about everyday people who are walking around with jobs who just are like, I can't afford healthcare. You know, so the deviancy in that are those who can afford healthcare. You know what I mean? All of us claim a particular sexual identity, orientation, or what have you. Where's the deviancy in that if we all have an orientation or an identification? Who's deviant, really? You know, because
That's something that I know the queer community is kind of trying to make into as lighthearted of a joke as we can, but everyone has pronouns.
everybody has pronouns.
Everyone has pronouns. Why
And
is it
sometimes,
suddenly a problem for you?
I don't know. And you know, I was reading something yesterday about the vice president who was on a disability panel and identified herself as her and hers. And she said, and I'm the one on the, with the blue dress. And I think it was Jared Kushner who accused her of pandering, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is, as some people said, from the standpoint of the community of the disabled, that's really important because you have people who are hard of hearing or what have you, for whom the visual is more important than the auditory, right? And so again, it's because we want to see people from our own lives, from the standpoint of our own lives. So from the standpoint of where I am, you're a deviant, right? As am I, right? And yet what folks fail to realize is you also are probably deviant yourself in your comparison of me, because in my community, you're not like me, right? Or you're deviant because you have an income I probably will never ever touch, you know? And so, but that level of self-reflexivity, which we engage in daily in American studies and which we try to teach people to think about, what does it mean when you begin to look at yourself from the standpoint of everyone else, you know, as opposed to looking at everyone else from the standpoint of you? That's a difference, because when you look at that microscope and you look at yourself and you're like, okay, these are the things that I experience, and okay, I don't even know anymore what's a norm necessarily.
What is a norm? What is a norm?
What is a
What
norm?
is a norm? You do cover so many different topics, and I wish that I had time to get to them all, but I do want to ask, just for people who may not be aware of it, one of the things that you do touch on quite often is the way that public policy affects food shaming specifically in the Black community, but I know that in other places you do talk about different intersectional identities. How is public policy affecting food eating, food shaming, and the way that we interact with those spaces?
Right. Well, you know, one of my friends and colleagues, sociologist Rashawn Ray, had a really good point one time. And he said, policies are written, but how they are carried out makes a huge difference. So we can start at the point of the policy itself, which is informed by how people who are writing those policies see the world and how they see other people in the world. So the policies themselves often are informed by stereotypes, they're informed by biases, and so forth. And then you have the second layer of how it gets enacted on the ground, right? Just because you have a policy that says, you know, X, Y, and Z, the tone with which that policy gets carried out can make the difference to the person who's on the receiving end. And Black folks often are on the negative side of the receiving end of this. And this isn't always, I need to be clear, it's not always, one of the things I make clear in this book is not always intra-racial, like white to Black, Latino to Black, but oftentimes it's interracial. And this is one of the things that I raise in the book that's probably going to make me unpopular, because Black folks often buy into these, you know, concepts of norm and bias as much as anyone else, right? And so when you have these kinds of food policies, whether they come from the government or elsewhere, that say, for example, this is what a standard or a model should be in terms of your weight, right? Or in terms of your your obesity, right? It you totally erase and eclipse people's cultural differences. I mean, from the days of Sanjay Bartman and the Venus Hottentot, if you will, from a black woman who had hips and buttocks and breasts that were full. Black folks were looked at and said, "Hey, that's ugly. That's a deviant because it doesn't look like our European women." And yet we know that one of the ways in which you get mulatto and octoroon and quadroons is because black folks were raped, black women, black men, black children were raped by white, people. And so rape is about power. And in many instances, when there was desire, it doesn't mean that black women or, were desiring to have children by white men. And so there was, even though in the world it said black bodies are undesirable, we know that that was not always the case. So again, I say these policies that get written are written and founded on historical biases and stereotypes and untruths. And we find ourselves having to fight against those and grapple with those in our everyday life today. And so that's how we end up with your food ways are bad because they're soul food, even though there are lots of cultures who have food that are heavily laden with salt, sugar, oil, so forth, but they're not considered bad and deviant. They're considered good for you and good tasting. So what is it that makes soul food, Southern food, food that were cooked out, and by and enjoyed in Black communities, the epitome of evil? The stroke belt is not, and I say this quoting a physician who I once went to, and she said, the stroke belt is actually in the South, the deeper South. She was like, because that's where you have high proportions of stroke and so forth. She was like, but it's not all related to food. A lot of it is related to low incomes, lack of opportunities, lack of transportation, lack of infrastructure around education, all of these other things. She was like, food just, for a lot of people is the thing that keeps people going.
Not to be glib, but what you just said reminded me of that argument that millennials of all ages, anyone who fits inside that generation of millennial has been told for, 15 years now, put away the avocado toast so that you can afford a house. Making
Absolutely.
this making two things that have absolutely nothing to do with each other, as though they are direct corollaries.
That's right.
And it's so funny. And I know several friends of
What
mine,
if
and I
you
have
eat
been joking.
avocado? What if that's all you have to eat because it's affordable for you? Is avocado and bread with tomato or what have you? What if
And
that's
at the end of the day, it's sort of like we were talking about earlier, someone who currently doesn't have financial means, having an iPhone is not indicative. It just means that they have how they got it,
Right.
how that's a whole different other story. That's a whole different other question. And that is not for you to assume. But it's just so interesting how we take existing in the world, you must follow this particular way of being, and any other little deviation. If you have this, if you ever enjoy yourself, if you ever enjoy yourself, you're not suffering in the right way for me.
Right. And that really is what we're talking about here, this sort of moralistic need to suffer to show that you are what worthy. My colleague Lisa Helke, philosopher, says it best. She's like, I applaud all these different ways of eating, but if you're on some ethical moral high horse, you should step away from that, and I talk about that in the book. But I want to sort of close out with something that I think many of us hadn't thought about. The shooting that occurred in Buffalo, New York, several months back, which was formerly my hometown. So when I heard that a shooting occurred in the Black community, I immediately said, was it on Jefferson Avenue? Because we lived around the corner from Jefferson Avenue, and that was our local grocery store, right? And Jefferson Avenue was the heart of Black community. And so when I looked at that, I said, whoa, now that was a white supremacist act. And what we tend to forget is when you start talking about people's spaces of relative safety or perceived safety, houses of worship, schools, grocery stores, places where we inhabit our everyday life, our homes. We got to take it one step further and say, now what, right? The gun control issue is its own animal. But from a food standpoint, conversations began to circulate like, where are these people now going to shop? Where do they shop? I read recently that the Tops had reopened. For a lot of people, that is not an entity or an establishment that they will ever be able to go into again, or perhaps at some point, but not right now. So, what happens to those folks? Where do they get their measure of safety and security in the acquisition of food? What's going to happen? What if you have an elderly person who has no other form of transportation except to walk or to catch, public transportation? Where are they now going to get their food? And our inability to take these sort of conversations where we're judgmental beyond that initial point to, oh my gosh, what happens now, really renders some of us inhumane, quite frankly. It renders us inhumane. And that circles back to the people who say, I don't see race. If you don't see race, and especially as it relates to our everyday lives and food being one of those many aspects, then you have to check your humanity because the ways in which food shows up in the world and how it shows up in our lives and the ways that we practice it very much is tied to who we are as racial beings, political beings, moral beings, ethical beings, sexual beings, religious beings, so forth and so on, able-bodied, disabled being, aged beings. All of that, it's all a part of the whole.
Dr. Psyche Williams-Forsen, I am so honored by your presence today. Thank you so much for being here. If folks want to connect with you, is there anywhere that they can do so online?
Oh, absolutely. I'm on IG, Instagram. I think I'm under building houses. One word. I can't tell you. It's either 7 or 9. Certainly, they can email me at pwforson@umd.edu, and I'm happy to respond to any dialogues that are open, and that will further good conversation. So, thank you for having me, Don.
Oh my
Really.
gosh, of course. Before you go, I want to ask you one final question, and it's what's your favorite food?
Oh, what's my favorite
What's
food?
your favorite? It's the last day you have on Earth. You have 20,
I
the aliens are coming
know.
right now. They're giving
You
you
know,
24 hours. What are you eating?
what am I eating? I am eating, if I had nothing else, I'm gonna eat either melon or salad. As I've gotten older, I love a
Love
good
it.
salad. I love a good salad, with all kinds of good stuff. And it has to have something crunchy in it. So
Oh, yeah.
yeah. So that's the other part of it is taste. We have to remember people enjoy taste. And taste is real. So thank
Well,
you so
thank
much.
you. Thank you so much for being here. You have a good rest of your day.
Okay, you too. Take care. Bye
Bye
bye.
now. That is going to do it for this episode of Head on Fire. Special thanks once again to my guest, Dr. Psyche Williams-Forsen. The book is Eating While Black: Food Shaming and Race in America. Go get it wherever you get your books. Before we wrap up today, I do want to give you all a quick programming announcement. Head on Fire has been picked up by the Audio Boom Podcast Network. What that means going forward is that this show will begin to create a stream of revenue for me so that I can do things like buy nicer equipment and possibly pay myself for the work that I do. This is a one-man operation. I do all of my own booking, all of my own recording, all of my own editing, all of my own uploading and scheduling and social media and all of that kind of thing. Some other bigger podcasts have entire teams of people that they outsource all of that to, and I don't. It's just me. So the ability to be able to earn any kind of money off of this show is great. What this means is that there are enough of you listening out there that a network took interest and thinks that what we're doing here at Head on Fire is pretty cool. Nothing is happening to the feed. You'll still be able to access this show in all of your regular places, and they'll probably be able to get me onto some networks that I wasn't on before. The one tweak you will notice is that there will start being ads run at the beginning and the end of the show. Those are placed there so that the new network can create a stream of revenue, can monetize the show. Please don't hate me for trying to make money off of my labor. I will tell you that if you hate ads, a really great way to continue to enjoy Head on Fire ad-free would be to give me as little as a dollar a month and join my Patreon, because patrons will continue to have access to full-length, ad-free, unedited podcast interviews well in advance of their public release. So there's even more of an incentive to join the Patreon. Which, of course, brings me to let you know that if you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Share it with your friends on social media. You can also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you happen to get your show. And while you're there, consider leaving a review. Reviews of any kind, even just a few emojis, help recommend the show to other listeners like you. You can also listen to ad-free, unedited, full-length episodes by joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons will receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and a monthly book club. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. If you'd like to connect with me on social media, I am at headonfirepod on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and I'm sure other social media networks that I have yet to discover. Thank you all so much for joining the show. Thank you all so much for tuning in and recommending the show and really starting to build an audience around Head on Fire. Without you all, this network announcement would not have happened at all. So the fact that there are folks out there that are recommending the show, continuing to leave reviews, continuing to tell friends about it, that just really means the world to me. If you don't mind, this next week would be really a good time. If you haven't ever told a friend about the show, now's a great time to do it. I will go ahead and tell you, I am going to be doing some giveaway stuff in the next episode to sort of celebrate the launch of the show on the Audio Boom Network, so be looking for that. Anyways, thank you all so much for tuning in. Thanks so much for downloading and streaming the show, and thank you so much for making Head on Fire the success it is. I have rambled on long enough, so I am going to go, but I'd just like to remind you, you can eat all the avocado toast you want. Mortgage underwriters really don't care.